OU Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayetze, or Vayetze, as would properly be pronounced. Recording and first broadcast of this show is Thursday, Yom Chamishi of Shabbat Parshat Vayetze, the fifth day of Kislev 5768, and the 15th day of November. In the category of things you don't know but probably are very, very anxious to know and very happy to know, today is Republic Day in Brazil, Peace Day in the Ivory Coast, and Shichi Go-San Day in Japan. Now that's a particularly interesting one. Shichi Go-San literally means 753. It's a traditional rite of passage and festival day in Japan for 3 and 7-year-old girls and 3 and 5-year-old boys. Now you know. One more cute thing about it. Its other name is, pardon my Japanese, Chito Siami, which literally means thousand-year candy, a traditional treat eaten to ensure longevity and health. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima Amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shima V'Koli Tehiena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'meafela la'ora u'mishibud l'geula. Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. A word about one of my favorite topics, Kiddush Levana. There's a 3-day after the Molad custom, which is known as Minhag Yerushalayim, based on the teachings of the Vilna Gaon. For them, for us, I shall say, first opportunity for Kiddush Levana was this past Tuesday evening. And we had clear skies, and I did manage to say Kiddush Levana at that first opportunity. The other common opinion is that which requires 7 full days from the Molad. The Molad this month was last Shabbat morning, early in the morning, and that means 7 days later is again Shabbat in the morning. First opportunity for the 7-day people would be Motzoi Shabbat. Motzoi Shabbat is also the preferred time for many other opinions, and there are actually some opinions that say that Kiddush Levana should only be done on a Motzoi Shabbat. The Minhag Yerushalayim is to take that opportunity after 3 full days from the Molad, no matter when it is, except Friday night. Friday night is acceptable for Kiddush Levana only when it's the last opportunity. But there is definitely a preference to Motzoi Shabbat because Kiddush Levana is considered a welcoming of the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, a monthly Kabbalat Pnei HaShekhinah. And as such, Motzoi Shabbat is when we find people who are properly dressed and well-groomed and more respectful presentation before the Shekhinah, so to speak. On the other hand, it's a moon-based thing, and it goes by number of days after the new moon, after the Molad. So this Motzoi Shabbat will be a very popular time, weather permitting, for Kiddush Levana, since it satisfies the seven-day people, as well as those who prefer or have the opportunity mostly on Motzoi Shabbat. Now let's do a little arithmetic. If today is the 5th of Kislev, and Chanukah is the 25th of Kislev, subtracting 25 minus 5, we get 20 days. 20 days, if memory serves correctly, is a tiny bit less than 3 weeks. In fact, the first candle of Chanukah is on a Tuesday night. It's already Thursday, so it's 2 days less than 3 weeks away. Certainly within the time frame of listening to an enjoyable Chanukah song based on the words from Al Hanisim.
Thank you. Beyond, beyond, from beyond, name beyond, push on beyond.
Okay, I'll be ready for a little Parshat Vayetze. Vayetze is very unusual in that the entire Sedra, the entire weekly portion of Vayetze, is contained in one single Parsha. Parsha, in the meaning that I'm using it now, refers to the divisions within a Torah scroll. There are no Sedra distinctions, chapter distinctions, verses marked in a Torah scroll. You've got words separated by a space, one after the other after the other. And the only divisions that you find in a Sefer Torah are known as parshiot. They come in two forms, what's called a parsha petucha, which in the common way of writing a Torah scroll means beginning that particular portion at the beginning of a line, following the previous parsha, which has the rest of the line left blank. The following parsha is called a parsha petucha, an open parsha, and a parsha situma. The previous parsha ends, a space on the same line is left of a certain minimum width, followed by the beginning of the new parsha, which is called a parsha situma, a closed parsha. The implications are that a parsha petucha is its own subject. A parsha situma generally follows the theme or the storyline of the previous parsha. It's related to it, but a subdivided portion thereof. And that's just a rough general outline. The point is that Parshat Vayetze, the Sedra of Vayetze, is a parsha situma. It follows very closely what we were talking about at the end of Toledot, namely, Rivka gets wind of the fact that Esav wants to kill Yaakov. She wants to protect her son Yaakov. She does not tell Yitzchak that Esav wants to kill Yaakov. Instead, she tells him that I want our son Yaakov not to marry any of the local girls here, but I want to send him to my family's home in Haran, and there he shall find a suitable wife. Yitzchak not only goes along with the idea, but takes the initiative to call to Yaakov, to give him the blessing of Abraham, and to send him to Rivka's hometown in order to find a wife. What's interesting is that, and this is a point that I wanted to make later, but I'll make it now. What's interesting is that we have Yitzchak, let's say, oblivious to the fact that Esav hates Yaakov and wants to kill him. His purpose of sending Yaakov is to find a wife. Rivka's ulterior motive is to save her son, and of course she wants him to go also. When we come to the beginning of Vayetze, we have the opening pasuk, Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er shava, vayelech charana. And Yaakov went from Be'er Sheva, where they lived, and he went to Haran. Commentaries discuss why the Torah tells us where he left from. Is that important? Why not just tell us that Yaakov went to Haran, because that's where the rest of the Sedra takes place, and we're interested in that aspect to it. Rashi says that the exit of a righteous person like Yaakov is felt in his absence in the place. Of course, he would make an impact wherever he went, but he would also leave a hole in the place that he left. But there's another explanation. I don't know which commentary says this, but I like it. And that is that this first verse in this week's Torah reading shows us Yaakov's compliance with his father's wish and his mother's wish. Or I should say his mother's wish and his father's wish. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. That's what she was interested in. Rivka wanted him out of Be'er Sheva, away from harm from Esav. Vayelech Charana, he went to Charan. That was in fulfillment of his father's wish, and his mother's also. So this is a demonstration of kibud av va'em, honoring and respecting parents. And I'll just say from practical experience, there are situations where satisfying one's wish does not necessarily comply with the other's wish, and it's a nice thing for a child not to be conflicted between parents and be able to do something which, even if the parents have different reasons for it, will satisfy both their requests. Back to the issue of Parshiot. Everything that happens in Vayetze is included in one large, very large, we're talking five columns in a Sefer Torah, approximately, and without a break. And even though we might think that these individual episodes would warrant their own Parsha, at least a Parsha Setuma, the point that the Torah is making is this is all one story. In fact, the entire weekly portion of Vayetze is very neat in that Yaakov at the beginning leaves Be'er Sheva and, in essence, Eretz Yisrael. And at the very end of the Sedra, after all of the events that happened, after 20 years, after his marriage to Leah and to Rachel, and then his production of a family with the birth of the Shvatim, he comes full swing, full circle, and at the very end we have V'Yaakov halach ledarko, Yaakov went on his way, V'yifge'uvo ma'alachei Elokim, he encountered angels, which is interesting because at the beginning of the Sedra, the very second verse, I think, it was V'yifgaba makom, he encountered the place, and here it's angels, and there he had a dream of angels, so it's a very neat full cycle. V'yomer Yaakov kasher ra'am machane Elokim zeh, v'yikra shem ha'makom ha'hu machanayim. The point is that he is now on the threshold of his return to Eretz Yisrael. So he leaves Eretz Yisrael. 20 years later, he comes back to Eretz Yisrael. Loads of things happen, but they're all part of a single story, as evidenced by the fact that they're all contained in a single parasha. Just another observation. Part of the story in Vayetze is the birth of the children who become Shivtei Kah, the tribes of Israel. And it is really remarkable that you have a relatively small number of verses that have such rapid-fire report of the births. I think it's a total of 16 verses where 10 or 11 children are already born. Maybe that includes Dina, so it would be 12. I have to go over it again, and maybe you'll take that as a challenge. If you're interested, the point is that we have a background of Avraham Avinu and Sarah. When we are first introduced to Sarah before she had her new name, she was Sarai. The Torah told us way back at the end of Parshat Noach that she was barren. And there's a long, long, long haul of her not having a child and having all kind of difficult time, including giving Hagar to Avraham and then having to face the mocking of Hagar, for she was able to have a child from Avraham and Sarah wasn't, and God's promise that Sarah will have a child and that he will carry on the Abrahamic tradition, so to speak. And we're talking about Yitzchak, and the point the Torah makes that Yitzchak And Rivka were not able to have a child for a period of 20 years, and Yitzchak was already 40 when he married her. So we're talking very few children in a very, very long period of time. And here, Yaakov marries Leah, who was supposed to marry Rachel, got switched with Leah. A week later, he married Rachel. And then the Torah tells us that Rachel was barren at the beginning, but Leah, God pitied her in her second favorite status to Yaakov and opened her womb, so to speak. And we have her getting pregnant, giving birth to a son. His name is Reuven, getting pregnant again, giving birth to a son. His name is Shimon, getting pregnant again, having a son. His name is Levi, getting pregnant again, one pasuk after the other, after the other. And now she acknowledges God and names the son Yehuda, and the pasuk tells us, Vaya amod miledet, she stopped having children at the moment. Rachel saw this, wanted children, still couldn't have them, gave her maidservant Bilhah to Yaakov, and immediately she becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son. Rachel names him Dan. She's pregnant again, gives birth to another son, names him Naphtali. And then Leah sees that she hasn't given birth, and obviously there's this dynamic of knowing by Ruach HaKodesh, some divine insight, that Yaakov was destined to have 12 sons who would become the Shvatim, and therefore Leah gives her maidservant Zilpah to Yaakov, and immediately she becomes pregnant and has a child. And actually, that's the one instance, that's an interesting question I have to look into, that the Torah does not say that she was pregnant, but she gave birth to a son. He is Gad, and then another son, and he is Asher. Leah has two more sons, Yisachar and Zevulun, and a girl named Dina, a daughter named Dina. And then finally, Rachel has Yosef. And all of that is so rapid fire that you have to be struck by the speed which we see it happening. We'll be right back with the second half of Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Vayetze. Stay tuned for Parshat Vayetze. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on Israel National Radio or OU Radio, or both, for Parshat Vayetze. But since we're into Kislev, we had one Hanukkah song. Let's listen to another. This one with the words from Ma'oz Tzur, not the familiar melody to most of us, but a beautiful one nonetheless. Yevanim Nikbetzu Alai.
Sakan kahanin
I've purposely chosen two songs today that are Hanukkah, but not the familiar Mo'ot, Tzur Yeshuasi, and all the other familiar songs to Hanukkah. I'll play some of those in coming weeks, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, but wanted to start the month of Kislev off with two very nice songs. I'll share with you the name of the album as soon as I find it. It's on my desk someplace. It's a re-digitalizing of an old album. And it was a whole collection of Hanukkah songs. And I like at least these two, if not more. We'll see what the future brings. I mentioned earlier that with Zilpah, it does not mention pregnancy, only birth, as opposed to the standard form of she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And Rashi makes the comment, I must have forgotten this, Rashi, Bechulan ne'emar he'rayon chutz mizilpa, all the others mention pregnancy except with Zilpah, because she was exceedingly young, and pregnancy was not expected, and was not that noticeable with her. And Rashi continues to say, based on a medrash, that this was part of the deceit of Lavan, because it was the custom to give an older handmaiden with an older child and a younger handmaiden with a younger child. And by giving Zilpah to Leah, it further gave Yaakov the opinion that he was getting the younger daughter, Rachel, who was the one he wanted to marry, rather than the switch for Leah. So that's the story there. I want to backtrack a little to the beginning of the Torah reading here, where we find a partial pasuk, part of a verse, which became the slogan of the Chabad movement, Ufaratzta yama vakedma vitzafona vanegba, and you shall strengthen and spread out to the east, to the north, to the south, and to the west. To the west, to the east, to the north, and the south. V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama uv'zarecha, and all peoples will be blessed because of your descendants. Now, Chabad, and I'm not finding fault, maybe a little tiny bit of criticism, but it's sort of, it's possibly I'm reading something into here that might not necessarily be so. Chabad, as many of you know, has populated every place in the world imaginable, and some you never heard of. And their philosophy is that if there is a Jew any place in the world, then a Chabad representative should be accessible to him to help him out with his Jewish spiritual religious needs, etc., etc. And the famous song, old song, Ufaratzta, sort of became one of the hallmarks of the Chabad movement. The reason that I'm bringing it up is here you have, let me backtrack for a moment to just include something else in here. I noticed the following yesterday, and it's something that everybody knows, but I paid attention to it in a specific context. Yitzchak Avinu was born, raised, and lived his entire life in the land of Israel, died there, and was buried there after 180 years. And there's no doubt from the verses in the Psukim that that's where he was supposed to be, and that's where he was supposed to stay, and God even had to say, don't do like your father did, and go to Egypt in the face of a famine in the land of Canaan, stay in this land. And he went rather to the territory of Avimelech, Melech Plishtim, which is part of Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu was born in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, and he was commanded at a specific age, Lech lecha me'artzecha umimoladetecha umibeit avicha, go from the place of your birth and from your land and from your father's home, El Haaretz Asher Areka, to the land I will show you. To sum it up in one word, Aliyah. A person born in Israel like Yitzchak cannot make Aliyah, not in the physical sense, because he's already in Eretz Yisrael. But Avraham was born not only physically in Chutz La'aretz, but to a family and a culture of idol worshippers, and his Aliyah, physically to Eretz Yisrael, and spiritually to the person that he was, who observed God's words to the last letter, including future commands, whatever that means, we have a different role model in Avraham Avinu compared with Yitzchak. Yaakov was born in Eretz Yisrael. He left for 20 years, and then he came back, and then he went down to Mitzrayim to see Yosef, and that's where he spent the last years of his life. He died there, and his body was brought back for burial in Eretz Yisrael. The point is that among the three Avot, we have one born outside of Israel who came to Eretz Yisrael, another one born and lived his entire life in Eretz Yisrael, and the third one born in Israel left and came back. So you have the model that Yitzchak is. If you were born and raised in Eretz Yisrael, this is where you belong, and don't leave, don't do Yiridah, which is the opposite of Aliyah. You have Avraham's model. If you were born anywhere else in the world, then Lech Lecha El Haaretz Asher Areka, go on Aliyah, come on Aliyah, go to Eretz Yisrael. And you have the example and the role model of Yaakov Avinu, who went to Chutz La'aretz, and he spent a lot of time there. You can say today's counterpart would be the Israeli who goes to Chutz La'aretz first to school and then to work a little, and then he gets involved and he gets married and he has a family and a home, but he makes the decision, the place where we belong is the land of Israel, and he returns. And there is a concept not only of Yiridah, and not only a concept of Aliyah, but a concept of Chazara, return to Eretz Yisrael, and it's covered there. Which brings me back to what I was saying before, because God appears to Yaakov in his famous dream with the ladder, and he says, the land which you at this moment are lying down upon, Lecha etenena ulzarecha, I give it to you and to your descendants. And then he mentions Ufaratz Tayama Vakedma Vetzafona Vanegba, but the intention is always that he should be here in Eretz Yisrael. Vihine Anochi Imach, I am going to be with you, God says. Ushimarticha b'chol asher teleich, I will guard you and watch over you wherever you go, but v'hashivoticha el ha'adama hazot, I'll bring you back to this land, ki lo e'ezavcha, I will not abandon you, ad asher imasiti et asher dibarti lach, until I fulfill what I have promised already. Basically what I'm trying to say is that Jews who don't live in Eretz Yisrael should live in Eretz Yisrael. Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael should stay in Eretz Yisrael. And Jews who leave Eretz Yisrael, including those who never left because they never were here, but who exist and live in Chutz La'aretz, should know that ultimately the place to be is Eretz Yisrael. You can make an excuse. Some excuses are better than others. There is ample precedent for sojourning, for temporarily dwelling outside of Eretz Yisrael, but people have to be honest with themselves that the bottom line is that this, meaning Eretz Yisrael, is where they belong, and not creating a wonderful Jewish community in X, Y, or Z. I'm not knocking that, but I'm knocking the part of that where people see it as an acceptable alternative for a Jew to live in Eretz Yisrael. There is no acceptable alternative. There are good things to do before you get here. There are important things to do if the facts require you to live outside of Eretz Yisrael. Kol HaKavod, and I mean that to the Jewish communities that have gone way, way overboard in creating a Jewish infrastructure that a person could live a wonderful, beautiful Jewish life in many parts of the world. It crosses an important line when the attitude is, this is a great Jewish life. Why risk going to Eretz Yisrael when I'd be going away from the wonderful Jewish community that I have? This is what the Meraglim said, and I know that I talk about this around Parshat Shlach and other opportunities, and I didn't mean to bring this up, but it's there. Yaakov had a very valid reason or two to leave Eretz Yisrael temporarily. And one was to save himself from his brother Esav, and the other was to find a wife. And in halachic literature, finding a wife is one of the acceptable reasons for leaving Eretz Yisrael. But it always should be with the proviso that this is a temporary thing. Now, people have to watch out for temporary being defined as 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, maybe 5 year, 10 year maximum, 20 years, 30 years, and onward. And the saddest are the people who left Israel or never came to Israel with intention of coming back or coming to Israel a year or two in the future and end up eventually, after many years, coming back on what is facetiously referred to as horizontal aliyah. That's not the way it should be. And I wonder if it should be like I hear from a lot of people that I know, when I retire, I hope to retire in Eretz Yisrael. To me, that's very sad, because I know the wonderful value to me and to my family of having lived in Eretz Yisrael all of these years. I'm not into regretting that I didn't come sooner. I probably should have, but I'm certainly thrilled and delighted to say that I came 26 plus years ago and haven't regretted it for a second. Again, I apologize, but only half so, for harping on this topic. It just seems so powerful. Train of thought, Shemitah year. Shemitah year in Israel is not easy. It certainly is not easy when Shemitah is in full force during the time when majority of Jews would be living in Israel and we have a Sanhedrin and everything like that. I imagine it's quite difficult. And because of rabbinic regulations, Shemitah is quite difficult no matter which path you choose to follow in Shemitah observance. One of the fringe benefits, I don't know if you could even call it that, I've often spoken about little tiny anecdotes which bring a tear to my eye and a smile in my heart for living in Eretz Yisrael. I was at one of the many Otsar Haaretz Shemitah stores around the country. This happened to be in Modi'in, where my daughter Aviva lives with a fine husband and a wonderfully cute grandchild of mine. And I went into the local Otsar Haaretz store and I bought a bunch of fruits and vegetables, some of the vegetables had Kedushat Shvi'it because they were Otsar Beitin. I don't know if we could go into what that means now. And others did not have the sanctity of the sabbatical year, because they were either still from the produce of the sixth year, or they were imported, or whatever. And I try, when I'm buying in that situation, to keep a different colored bag for that which has Kedushat Shvi'it and that which doesn't. And there I get my cash register receipt, and I look, and every item that had Kedushat Shvi'it was labeled Kedushat Shvi'it. There's tomatoes, X number of grams, the fee per kilogram, the total, and the words Kedushat Shvi'it. And there was whatever it was, I don't even remember anymore, that did not have Kedushat Shvi'it, and it was not labeled that way. This is a wonderful feeling to be able to observe Shemitah, not just in theory, and not just learn about it and pine for it, but to live it. And we don't. I'm not a farmer. I don't have that first-hand experience of Shemitah, except for different rules about plants that you might have on your balcony that are exposed to the air, and you have to treat them a certain way, and people who have lawns have to behave a certain way, and trees in their backyard. But even the city slicker, if he wants to buy a kilo of tomatoes and cucumbers, and he does not want to buy Arab produce, or does not want to rely on the Heter Mechira, which again I won't go into in depth now, and wants to follow the path of the best possible Shemitah observance, buys in one of these special stores, and has that extra little tiny thrill of the cash register receipt saying on it, Kedushat Shvi'it. It's not hard. It requires that when I cut up a pepper to eat, I take the core with part of the stem and the little bit of flesh of the vegetable around it, and I put it into a separate bag, and I leave it for 24 hours at least, if not more, until it begins to spoil, and then double wrap it, which is more than you need to do, and then you could throw it away. It's an awareness in a very mundane way of sanctity. Again, train of thought. I was in HaSofer, wonderful Sofer Stam establishment this morning, and I happened to see a scrap of klaf, piece of parchment, and I noticed that there were the special lines that are scratched in for the writing of a mezuzah. This was obviously a side piece of the klaf, and I asked what's to be done with it. Does a piece of parchment, a scrap that's trimmed off the side of a large sheet, have sanctity? Turns out that when you prepare parchment for the writing of tefillin, mezuzah, or sefer Torah, it requires the working of the parchment to be done for the sake and the sanctity of that which you will write on it, and it imparts sanctity to the parchment even before anything is written on it. And we had a discussion about what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do with it. But there, I was in a context of sacred objects, Torah, tefillin, mezuzah, and here I'm talking about tomatoes and cucumbers, and their sanctity there also. That's part of what it means to live in Eretz Yisrael HaKadosha. And in the future, Mirtz Hashem, it'll even be more so. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.